older generation, they don't know who they are. They don't identify with themselves whatsoever, and they're lost. They maybe call a number of things, any name, just about any name except nigger, or maybe in some cases you could call a nigger would be accepted. Colored, it gives me the impression that this white man was just trying to, you know, hang a tag on this man, because when you look at something and you say it's colored, that means it's filled in with something. It's you know, it's not the original thing, and it's just been filled in, like somebody's been drinking chocolate milk or something, you know, colored. The younger generation only accepts one, and that's black. That's identifying with oneself, with one's people. Black people wear naturals to identify with themselves, to be free to wear their hair the way it's supposed to be. This is the way the hair is supposed to be. This is the way a person was born, and this is the way he should die, with his hair natural. He shouldn't die with curls or hot combs in his hair after he's lived his life. His hair has never been natural. His hair has never been original. The way it was when he was born. When a black baby is born, his hair is not pressed, it's not curled, it's natural, it's like it's supposed to be. And this is the way a person should end his life, with his true identity of knowing who he is.
There has been a time when the so-called Negro was ashamed of the way he looked. And he used every method in the books to try to emulate the whites. They straightened their hair, they processed it, they used various creams, and they did every possible way to eradicate their original style and his original customs. And it's got a certain awareness lately, possibly since the riot in 65 that started somewhere in this vicinity. There's a certain awareness that has come upon the black man or the Negro, whichever is preferred. It's just, I'm proud of the way I look, and I'm going to be who I am regardless, and my hair is my business, and I like the way I look, and we've done everything to beautify it. The natural is a style that is strictly Negroid style. And it's the hair that makes a difference. That's the one thing that we have that other people can't have like. So we're going to justify our cause and be proud of who we are and how we wear our hair and the style, to do everything we can to beautify it. There's several types of naturals. There's excessively long, referred to as the Africanoid natural. There are the Americanized naturals. There's a moderate natural. And the natural in between, the guy wears his hair at any length that he wants, as long as it's kept clean and it's not slicked down or processed. It's kept clean and well-groomed. You can wear short natural, even down to a Quo Vadis style. That's where it's excessively close to show the complete shape of the head. But the main feature about a natural is cleanliness. It radiates a certain desire to want to be clean.
I used to wear my hair pressed and curled, and I wore it that way until I was about 18. And then I began to wear natural. At the time, I wore natural because to me it was a fad, you know, like the mini dress that came out. And I got tired of the natural, and I started to get my hair pressed again. And I wore it for a while, and I couldn't style it. I couldn't do anything with it. So I started wearing the natural, and I felt myself, you know. Something came out to say I wanted to wear my hair like this. And because this is the way I came in the world. I didn't come in here with it pressed and curled, you know. I came in here with it nappy, just like it is with black, beautiful hair, you know, and I'm black. So I've been wearing a natural now for almost 2 years. And My friends, the ones that's wearing the natural, they feel the same way I do or can express themselves a little bit different. But I have a few bourgeois friends that are still trying to be somebody else. And what some people call the Caucasian and what some people call the honky, they're still trying to be like those people.
Well, I don't consider myself trying to be like a white woman. I only wear my hair the way I do because that's the style that I like. I'm a Negro, and I am proud of it. As far as a white person is concerned, I wouldn't want to be like them because the good Lord made me the way I am, and that's the way I like it. Pressing your hair is just like combing your hair, only the comb is worn. I have been getting my hair pressed and curled for a long time, so I have really gotten used to it. It gives your hair, I think, more body. It takes about 45 minutes to get a shampoo, press, and curl. I go at least twice a month, and I get my hair shampooed and dried, and she press it and curl it and style it. I have a number of friends that wear natural, and on some of them, they do look nice. It all depends on how they keep them up. Personally, I don't like natural. Just like clothes, it all depends on the person and their taste. I pick the style I think is becoming to myself, and what I like, I wear. I don't like naturals, especially on myself.
My mother, she doesn't like it at all. She's a little old-fashioned, and she doesn't like it at all. She thinks I should still get my hair pressed. My son, he's wearing a natural now because it's something that I should get him, you know, used to in a way, because something to let him know that that's him and nobody else's hairdo is not his. And that's the way I feel about a natural. As myself wearing it, because it's me, it's naturally me, the way it is now.
Negroes have had to do with what they've had so long, till I think they have, it's just part of their cooking, where they've always had to improvise.
A Pacific soul food dinner. Chitlins, hog maws, black-eyed peas, mustard greens, okra, and cornbread. A very large glass of milk. Dessert, a very large piece of peach cobbler.
And the type of food that I was raised on was greens, cornbread, salt pork, in the greens, black-eyed peas out of the garden. Well, all the vegetables come out of the garden. And chitlins in the wintertime when they would kill hogs, bag bones, and baked sweet potatoes. That was, as we call it, soul food now. And that was the beginning of my cooking. And as I grew up, I would watch my mother fix various dishes, you know, and I would learn. As far as the recipes is concerned, I didn't know what the recipes was. I just learned through watching my mother, you see.
Your greens are grown wild. You have wild greens, you have mustard greens, you have different varieties of greens, and all of these had to be determined, which were good and which ones were not good. Sweet potato pies, rice pudding, peach cobbler, all these things were not even thought of by white people until black people came along and took these things and made delicacies out of them. Say if a slave was in the field and he ran across a field of, say, sweet potatoes, he could he would look at this and he would wonder if he could eat it, because that after all he got the leftovers. And when he looked at this sweet potato, he would probably say, well, I could take this home and try to make something out of it. After 400 years of experimenting with a sweet potato, naturally you're going to come out with something. And this is what happened. As far as chitlins are concerned, chitlins were derived way back when we were slaves. And say, for instance, if the white slave master had slaughtered a hog, and maybe he cut the ham and the bacon and all the, you know, the good meat that they ate then off of this hog, and say he threw the guts away of this hog, the guts, that's what they were known as then. And if a slave woman happened to see this garbage laying around, well, she would ask this white slave master for it, and that's what he'd give it to her. And she would take this back to her shack, and she would cook it. She would put her touch to it. She would just put that soul in there that would make it taste like a delicacy.
You have to be very careful with chitlins when you're cleaning them. You have to clean them. Take very care in cleaning them. Clean them very good. Make sure that all the, you know, they have the tendency to have the hair from the hog on there. Make sure all of that's off. And I wash them and I clean them. I put them in the pot. Salt, pepper, cut an onion up in them. And, well, we always cook by 10 pounds because the whole family come over when we have chitlins.
Well, the older black people, they like stuff like chitlins, hog maws, pig feet, neck bone, hog head, and the pig snoot, and mountain oysters. This is something that the old people like, man. And us younger brothers and sisters, we only dig beef, you know, because the swine ain't doing nothing but it's dead meat, man. You can't even kill a hog, man. You can't poison him, you know. That's the only animal you can't poison in the world. Take the hog from the old people, man, it's just like trying to take the country out of them, man, and that's impossible, you know, because they were mostly raised in the country, man. They wouldn't rebel against anything, you know. They was more or less the hey boy, yes sir kind, you know. we're not that race no more, you know. We are almost a separate race, man, when it comes down to food. Another thing, we are in color and beliefs, some beliefs. But when it comes down to food, to take that hog away from a man, it'd be just like taking their life.
I go to the white neighborhood to do most of my shopping now, because I find out that in the black community, the vegetables, the fruits, and even the canned goods is much different than what they are in the white neighborhood. In the white neighborhood, the vegetables are fresh, crisp, nice. In the black neighborhood, they are dry. They are not fresh. The canned goods are bent.
All soul food is high in our neighborhood because that's why most people buy it. But I don't buy it because I like to save money. I like to know where mine's going. Say, for instance, I buy a pound or two of soul food, say, a batch of chitlins, 10 pounds. And maybe in here they're not real good. And then I don't buy anymore. Once I get bit, I don't buy anything else. I go out of the neighborhood. We get in an old car and we tick-tick way out somewhere where we can find something that's a better quality of food.
Some of the cans in the black community are rusty. You don't find that in the white community. The meats in the black community, the prices are high. The meats are not fresh. And the quality is, they put so much in a package until you're not really able to buy what you want. You have to buy a larger amount in order to even buy the meat in the black community.
Now, for instance, a merchant in this neighborhood will sell a product maybe for a dime or a nickel more in the Negro neighborhood, where in the white community, he'll sell it for a nickel or a dime less. And this, I do know for a fact, is true.
For instance, if there's a piece of furniture that the low-income family have longed for, and suddenly someone comes along and say, well, now, I'll fix it where you can get it. So you give me 10 blue chip stamp books, and we'll call that the down payment. Well, the average family has 10 blue chip stamp books because he gets stamps everywhere. So he'll just turn in this 10 blue chip stamp books, and then he take the next 5 years trying to pay for a $25 piece of furniture. So economically, this is the same situation. I'll see to it, the attitude is I'll see to it that you don't get out of debt. So if I can't get you in the cotton field, I'll get you in the furniture store.
And it's one reason I'll tell you, I say why the white man is a snake in the grass. The white man will train you for any kind of job that he wants you to do. He'll train you for any kind of job that the white woman or man will not do. I don't care what it is that the white person won't do. If the black person don't know how to do it, the white man is willing to train you, no matter how much time, how much money he have to spend to do it, because he know the white man or woman is not going to come in there and do it. But he won't train you for the better jobs. He'll save his better jobs, his best paying jobs, for the white.
Well, I know I've had jobs in different places before I started working where I'm working at now, and I had asked my boss once, I was working in a linen supply, and I asked my manager, could I go in the office? And he said, well, I'll see, you know. So I said, okay, fine. He said, so later on, I asked him again about the job. So he said, well, they didn't have any openings in the office. So this was fine, which I knew was wrong, because that's why I had asked for the job. I knew it was an opening there. So a few days later, here is this old white girl. Her hair is straight. If personally, if I had a business, she couldn't even enter the door if it was left up to me. So she gets the job. So the white man, he feels as though he would rather have a white woman, regardless of what she looks like, whether she's ugly or fat or skinny, whatever. He'd rather have her because she's white than to hire a decent, clean, intelligent Negro girl. I finished high school at the age of 17. And at this time, I was qualified, so I thought, for a job in the world. So at this particular time, I had saw the job, and I went down to apply for it. So when I got there, I passed the physical and the written examination. So the guy, after he couldn't find anything wrong with my test, he tells me, he says, well, I don't think that you would enjoy working in this office where they're all white people. And this experience hit me with such a blow, because at 17, I'm thinking the world is in the palm of my hand, you know. So I don't remember till the day how I left that office. It hit me with just that hard of a blow. I go, and when I do come to my senses, I'm sitting on the bus stop, and the guy on the bus opens the door, and he says, lady, what's wrong with you? It was just that obvious that something had really upset me, you know. So I walk home in a daze after I get off the bus, and when I get here, all I could do was cry. I just cried.
Some of the frustrations of living in the ghetto is the crowdedness, the police, nowhere to go, nothing to do, no jobs, worrying about whether or not you're going to live today for tomorrow.
Like waiting on a bus, man, you be on the bus stop for, you be on the bus stop for about an hour or so, man. And by that time, one of your partners be done came by and you be done got a ride. But the old people, man, they sit there all day trying to wait for a bus.
If you're on a bus stop waiting on a bus, you feel as though it's never going to get there. You keep looking down the street to see if you can just see one iota of the color of that bus to see if it's anywhere in the distance, to count how many blocks it is down. And when you see it, you're hoping it's the right bus.
And over at the red bus, it's just one bus. It'd have to make its rounds around and come back. And if you get there just as it leaves, you have to wait till it makes its all around circle before it'll come back and pick you up.
If you don't have a car, you can't even begin to move. You have to have an automobile before you can even think about getting to a job or getting to find a job or getting anywhere in town. A car is practically mandatory. You have to have transportation. And a fellow will, if his car breaks down on him, he doesn't have any money to put it in a shop or anything. So what he has to do what we call a shade tree mechanic. A shade tree mechanic is a mechanic that doesn't have anything but a pair of pliers, a 9/16 and a screwdriver, and maybe a coat hanger to wire anything up that happens to be loose. A car is something that you can just buy on any used car lot. A car is a common car off the assembly line. But this is not considered as a ride. A ride is something luxurious. Whenever a black man has a ride, he has more or less say just what the word says, a ride. He doesn't have to get up under the hood and mess with the distributor or the carburetor. He doesn't have to do nothing but put gas in it and ride. A ride would be a new car, a 68 Eldorado, a 68 Riviera, or something of that nature. It wouldn't be no junk, and it wouldn't be nothing that was way back. It wouldn't be no more than 2 or 3 years off. It would be something new. All he has to do is get in there and turn the key. And when he goes down the street, he doesn't feel a bump in the road. Everything is smooth, smooth, smooth. The younger generation figures that they ought to be able to put their car the way they want to put it. This is the generation that's more demanding and figures they ought to run, they ought to govern themselves instead of this white society governing them. Their cars are low. They're mostly in the younger generation. They're mostly teenagers, your lowriders. This car is different. This car is different because it's low. And maybe it may have some different color paint job, some flashy paint job. He's distinguished from everybody else. He's noticeable. So he catches a lot of harassment by the police. But them white boys can low ride all day long, all of them down the street, and the police won't say nothing. But when the police comes into the ghetto and sees a low rider, it's always a ticket. It is hard keep your license because you're watched so closely by the police. And anything that you happen to do, the police is right there looking at it.
This is where most of the laws are broken because on account of economical reasons why they're broken. They're not broken because the people out in the community want to break them. A guy can't come out and he can't say, I can do this and I can do that. No, he got to think John crank his car up out there across the street tomorrow morning. It might smoke like hell. It might have one wheel and one wheel off and one wheel on, but John's going to try to go to work in that car anyhow. Then he drives down the corner, and first thing he do, LAPD bust him. Why? Because John got one wheel off and one wheel on. But they would stop and think how much money John making. John making $1.25, $1.50, $1.60 an hour. So how can John afford to put a tire on the car? How can John can afford to get a better car?
It's almost impossible to go without getting a ticket in our community because the police harass us so much till they find something. You know, they'll pull us over there, check our brakes. They check our tires. They'll see if we're too low. They'll check our windshield wiper. And brake lights. And then they check our dimmer switch to see if our bright lights and things work like that. Any kind of hazard, man, anything they can to give us a ticket.
When a cop stops you, he's going to check you out for warrants. If there are no warrants, he's going to come back to your car. He's going to check out everything on that car. If he can't find anything in that aspect of the car and there's no warrants and there's nothing wrong with you, you're not wanted for anything, everything is clean, he's going to be very upset. The
majority of us brothers do have records, man, because we get picked up on the weekend, we go to jail, and we might have a job, man. And And they'll release you anytime they want to on Monday, ma'am. They can release you Monday morning or Monday night. It doesn't make a difference. And when you go back to tell your boss, he asks you where you've been, you know, you got a job to do, you know. And you go back and tell him you've been incarcerated for the weekend. And the first thing you do is wonder why and lay you off. And then the next thing, you know, you don't have a job. You don't have a job, you know, you're not working nowhere. And then you got it, there you are, back on the streets again. You got to do something.
A black man is forever looking over his shoulder because practically anything we do is considered wrong in the police's point of view. So we have to watch ourselves very carefully. Whenever I see a police car, I get that feeling of defense or self-defense. This is the feeling I get. I feel like that is the enemy. That is the one who inflicts the pain.
Black on Black will continue in a moment on KNXT Los Angeles. Black on Black is being brought to you by the Alberto Culver Company. The broadcast continues now without commercial interruption.
A lot of people live in the ghetto that are pretty well taken care of financially. Just because they live in the ghetto don't mean that they can't afford nice furniture. Just because they live in the ghetto doesn't mean that they can't drive a nice car. A lot of people, they have homes in these ghettos that they're nice homes. They started from nothing. They've added on, they've put to it, and they built their homes up. And naturally, they don't want to leave this. I'm only 24. I bought my home 2 years ago at 22. I have two kids. My husband, he works. I work. And the majority of my friends are not doing as well as I am because you have to be able to manage in order to have anything. Or you have to want something in order to have it. I wanted to have a home. I wanted to have kids. I wanted to have everything that it took to make a life for myself. And I struggled, and I got a husband that wanted the same thing. And this is why we're so far ahead. It takes two to pull, you know. One can't do it by themselves. Personally, when I enjoy living in the ghetto. I really do. I enjoy. I would much rather live in the ghetto than live on the hill and look down on the ghetto.
I moved in the project because the house that I was living in was wasn't large enough for my family. So we had to move into the project. I don't live here because I want to, and don't live because I like it. I live in here because I have to. You don't have no privacy in the project. It's no privacy. You just live in a unit. Everybody knows everything the other one do. It's not private at all. I wash, you wash. You move over your clothes off and I'll hang mine up, whether they wet or dry. You can't even sit out on the lawn. Somebody come along and spit where you're sitting. Actually, anything in the project you don't call your own, because the people, the project, they'll knock on the door, and if you don't answer them immediately, they'll take the key and walk right on in. And sometimes I wish I could just move out right now and just, but I know I'll have to stay until I can find something that I can go. But nowadays, everybody's for themselves. As they call it now, it's a dog-eat-dog world. And this don't have to be. I have 13 children, and my husband is the father of all of them. But we have so many others in my neighborhood, all around me, have 9 children, and every child have a different father. One woman have 7. And neither of hers have the same father. All of them have a different father. Maybe you have
one that the father brings something over to him. Maybe.